This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Much of the development in Cincinnati and Northern Kentucky's urban centers is driven by generous tax incentives. And recently, Cincinnati City Council approved more than $220 million in downtown residential development projects, all with public assistance or tax breaks. But only one project will include affordable housing. Should all these new development projects that receive public assistance do the same? Let's discuss. Joining Cincinnati Edition, our Cincinnati City Councilwoman, Tamaya Dennard. Welcome, Tamaya.
Thank you.
Councilman David Mann. Welcome, David.
Hey, Michael, how are you?
And on the phone is Northern Kentucky Community Action Commission Executive Director Katrina Bowman Thomas. Welcome, Katrina.
Thank you so much.
And it's 513-419-7100. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can also email talk at wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets and try to get some of those into the show as well. So we're here today because of some tweets that you sent out, Councilwoman, in response to the votes at City Hall not that long ago about these developments. This was $220 million worth of development projects that were coming in, all receiving some sort of tax abatement on behalf of the city government. I want to read a little bit of what you tweeted out then. Quote, "Yesterday was a tough day at City Hall. As a council, we approved quite a few deals that offered zero units of affordable housing, but asked for 100% tax abatements. Tax abatements mean that someone doesn't pay taxes for a certain period of time." You go on to explain that you voted no against all the residential deals that had no affordable units, which was only one that had any affordable units. And you continued, quote, "If a developer doesn't want to build affordable housing, that is totally okay. They just shouldn't get a handout from the city. Rent in the city of Cincinnati is high as hell." What should be the city's policy, Councilwoman, as it relates to tax incentives for developments that don't include affordable options outside of what you tweeted there?
I mean, obviously, we want to have, you know, new development in the city. We want people to move into the city. But unfortunately, there's been either through policy or the narrative has been or the policy has created the narrative that it's either or, it's binary. So we can't, we can invite people in, but we got to make sure people can afford to stay. And that's the issue. Cincinnati, we're a bleeding population of people because of affordability. We're also, think about a family of two or three trying to find a place to live inside the city proper that can't pay $1,500 or $2,000 a month. It's hard to do. And so we have to be able to look at both new development, new people moving here, but making sure people can afford to stay here.
And Councilman, you supported the projects, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are on Councilwoman Dennard's position on this and how you do that balancing act of trying to attract new development while also maintaining some sense of affordability for the general population.
You know, it is a balancing act, and it's a broader discussion really than just should we give tax abatement. I want to talk about what that means in a bit. But one of the things that there's been a lot of discussion about at City Hall and some initiatives is our shortfall of affordable housing. Affordable housing means you've got to pay more than a third of your income to housing. And in Hamilton County, tonight, there are 40,000 families that are required to pay more than that 30%. In the city of Cincinnati, it's 28,000. One solution, of course, is to improve the incomes of everybody or as many people as possible. Then what's affordable changes. In the last year, we have created an affordable housing trust fund. It's funded in two ways. One is a piece of any abatement opportunity is accompanied by a commitment from the developer to pay 15% in lieu of taxes housing. Half of that goes to the neighborhood, half of that goes to the citywide affordable housing trust fund. Secondly, we have a new tax on Airbnbs of 7%, and that kicked in July the 1st, and every penny of that goes to affordable housing initiatives. And in year one, which just is 6 months of taxing, we expect to collect about $600,000. So over time, we're going to develop a significant ability to address the affordable housing issue. Now, tax abatement, nobody gets 100% taxes abated. Nobody always, 25% of payments in lieu of taxes are made to the school board. As of 2 years ago, there's another 15% that's paid by the developer. Within the downtown, that 15% goes to support the streetcar. In the other neighborhoods, the 15% is as I described. Sometimes the discussion assumes that, you know, we're giving away money that we have. If a development doesn't take place, there are no taxes to collect. So what we are always trying to do is evaluate a development and determine whether it is true, as all developers claim, that they can't make the numbers work without some assistance. And we have a Department of Community and Economic Development spends a lot of time analyzing proposals, explains to us their thinking when it comes before the Budget and Finance Committee, which I happen to chair. And we don't give – sometimes we give less than full abatements, that is less than the 60%. Sometimes we shorten the number of years that they're available, and we're always trying to figure out what will cause development to take place in the city, which, by the way, is good.
And we do hear that a lot about, particularly when it involves an old building, a historic building has to be transformed.
An empty building?
it can't possibly be redeveloped for a profit by a commercial developer without some investment from the city in the terms of incentives. So, Councilwoman Dinard, how do you then balance that? If you see an area of town where people like, we need some development here, or even you see the need for development there, do you see that the city should implement some sort of requirement that leans towards affordable housing regardless?
Absolutely. I mean, I've voted for my fair share of tax abatements. Tax abatements are a great tool to incentivize development. But once a community has hit that tipping point, it's incumbent upon us as policymakers, which I'm committed to this summer, is rewriting what that looks like. I mean, Cincinnati, I commend my colleague for some really creative and awesome efforts to, you know, mitigate the issue of lack of affordable housing over time. The issue is we don't have time. Time's not on our side. Right now, we have 28,000 units of affordable housing shortage in the city of Cincinnati. If you know anything about poverty, you know that upward mobility rates are low. So chances are, if you were born impoverished, you're going to remain impoverished. And so our incomes are not growing at the rate that we would like them to grow. So I do believe tax abatements can provide an incentive. However, we cannot keep giving away abatements and not getting anything in return. The land is finite. We're not going to annex Norwood or Springfield Township anytime soon. So we only have...
Maybe we should.
I'm open to that discussion. But the point is, we can't grow more land. And so it's incumbent upon us to be better stewards of what we have. And in doing so, that means to create policies that are more inclusive of people who don't have, who don't make $70,000 or $80,000 in the city, but deserve and have a right to live in the city of Cincinnati.
I wonder if there's a stigma associated with the term affordable housing, or even a misunderstanding of what it means. David, you did a nice job of explaining of what it is. Housing and Urban Development Department at the federal level indicates that it's families paying more than 30% are considered cost burden. That's 30% of their annual salary on housing cost. Right. But affordable housing doesn't necessarily mean Section 8. And we know there are stigmas associated with that as well. I don't want to heighten those, but there is a distinction. I want to bring Katrina in here from the Northern Kentucky Community Action Commission and get your thoughts, Katrina, on that. Do you think that there's a misunderstanding or a stigma associated with the idea of affordable housing?
Definitely. And we're seeing, you know, the same issues in Northern Kentucky. 30% of all of our renters are overburdened, which means they're paying more than 30% of their income towards their rent. And so what we've done through Northern Kentucky Community Action Commission is we've actually had some of these housing development deals. And that is true. Some people have that stigma that they think, oh, it's Section 8 housing. It's going to be this. It's going to be that. But the reality is, you would never know. If you pull up at one of our housing developments, Magnolia Glen, for instance, it just looks like a normal apartment complex. We've not had any other issues outside of what a normal apartment complex would have. So it is very different than what I think people perceive it to be. And we've seen it to be very beneficial. We've had a lot of long-term residents that have stayed there since we built it. It's been there for 5 years because it is affordable, because it's nice, it's well-maintained. And it's just like a regular apartment unit.
I saw this play out, this confusion over affordable housing and Section 8 in the city of Ludlow. And for those of you who may not know, it's just directly to the west of Covington on the riverfront there. And the city council was considering its largest ever residential development project to be right at the gateway. It would have been new construction. But because of some Kentucky tax credits that the developer was seeking, it had to include a certain percentage, about 30% of affordable units. And the developer seemed to have a hard time explaining to the public there that we're not talking about putting a Section 8 development at the doorstep of the city. We're talking about entry-level professionals, teachers who would probably qualify for the income threshold to be able to rent one of these units in Ludlow. And because of the public's concern about Section 8 housing being placed at the doorstep of the city of Ludlow, it seemed like that was the motivation for council to vote that entire project down. So there is no development there. And as Katrina said, Northern Kentucky is also seeing this. We just had a report that came in my inbox shortly before we went on air. This is from Yardi. They create this software for property managers, and they analyze rent in cities in all the states, and they provide a list of the cities. Newport, according to Yardi, has the highest rent, average rent in Kentucky. This is only for apartment developments that have 50 or more units in them. But the average rent for such a unit in such a development in Newport is $1,137. And when you think about the concentration of low-income residents in Northern Kentucky, you find that, Katrina, in Covington, and you find that in Newport. So what's in place for those folks who live in Covington and Newport and don't meet that income threshold? What are the resources available to them?
Right now, there's very few resources out there that's available. One thing that we've been able to take advantage of is the low-income housing tax credit, as you have mentioned before. So there are a few developments, but you see, mainly in those areas, they're for a specific population. Like in Covington, we have taken Lincoln Grant Scholar House, that was a historically black school, and renovated that into 45 apartments for single parents while they're going to college. And so you see some special population type of housing, but really that's the majority of what you see right now. So a lot of people are moving out into other areas to try to find housing that's more reasonable for them.
I want to talk about the impact on the greater region. We're seeing these apartment projects come in. We're seeing them fill up rather quickly. I know at the beginning there's questions like, how much of this can we handle? I don't think we've met that threshold yet, because people are certainly filling up and then they're patronizing the businesses that are popping up as well. So it's good for the economy, but the impact on the greater region in terms of who has access to it and who's being denied, we're going to discuss that when we return from this short break. And then later, how noisy restaurants in the area can have a negative impact on diners with hearing loss. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue now with a look at the suggestion that more affordable housing units should be included in the apartment projects that are going up in the region's urban center. And we're joined on Cincinnati Edition today by Cincinnati City Councilwoman Tamaya Denard, Councilman David Mann, and on the phone is Northern Kentucky Community Action Commission Executive Director Katrina Bowman-Thomas. We'd love to hear from you as well. 513-419-7100 is the number to call. You can email talk at wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and tweets and try to get some of those into the show as well. So just before we went to that little break, I was asking about just in general, what does it mean for the region? And we'll start with you, David. What does it mean as a whole for the region that the economy is certainly benefiting from the new developments? And there are people with disposable income living in them and patronizing the businesses. But there are people who don't have access to that. What does it mean overall for a region like this?
Well, I think the challenge, and I think the issues that Tamaya raises are very valid, is if we get all done with the renaissance of Cincinnati and repopulated, and there are no poor people left in the city of Cincinnati, we have failed. We have lost our soul as a city. So we have to do both. And the city has a lot of programs trying to balance. Tamaya makes the point that as we approved abatements, we should, to the extent possible, ask that some of the units be affordable. Then we have to provide a definition of affordable, which can vary according to what percentage of area mean income you want to have able to live in the space, whether it's workforce housing or really low-income housing. And in both areas, there are needs. So, and, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, at the end of the day, the city doesn't have the capacity to right all the wrongs. It has some. It has the ability to shape some public policies, and that's what we try to do. And increasingly, because of Tamai and some others, we're asking the question of residential developers, okay, how many of the units are going to be affordable, and what do you mean by affordable? And sometimes they say, well, we mean that if your income is 80% of area mean income, you don't have to spend more than 30%. Well, what about somebody who's much poorer whose income is 30% of area mean income? We want housing for those folks also.
And Tamai, what do you see as a benefit of having people who qualify for affordable housing units being part of the Renaissance down here?
I mean, we could talk about economics, but actually, because of how disparities are set up, disproportionately, you're going to be talking about African-American people. So it's not just the city that's going to be losing people of lower incomes. They're going to be losing an African-American population. I think one thing that's getting lost in the conversation is that Cincinnati's in the top 15 in the country in evictions. And that's not coincidental. That's not happenstance. That's just that's because of policy and people being priced out that we're leading one of the leaders in the country in evictions. That's not something that we want to lead the country in. But I go back to your point about the development in Ludlow about, you know, low income housing being at the doorstep of the city. What if it is? Like, that's the issue for me. Like, I challenge that at the premise. So what if the people who are welcoming, the first thing that people see when they come into the city of Ludlow are people who have low income? That's okay with me. The issue is, too, like when we're talking about affordability, I think the narrative has to change. We're not just talking about a single mom with three kids or a single dad with two kids. We're talking about college students who are graduating from college, 23 years old, and the market, you know, doesn't, you know, the job market isn't allowing them to come out and make $70,000 a year. They make $35,000 a year. They should also be able to live in a safe community. So we do have to broaden and change the narrative on what affordability is. But we can't ignore the fact that you know, Cincinnati is not, if we continue the path that we're going, we have a shortage of affordable housing. I'm curious, and I'm not trying to throw you and my colleagues under the bus, but how do they think we arrived at the shortage? So that's why I'm really grateful for David Mann, because he knows that it's policy that has to change. He goes back to policy every single time. And that's why this summer, while we're on break, unquote, I'm committed to changing or writing policy that's more inclusive.
I'm noticing something, and this is anecdotal, I suppose. I don't have any data here, but I'm noticing, you know, I also publish the River City News, an online daily paper in Northern Kentucky, and it has a very active Facebook page. And we've documented very closely the urban revitalization on the south side of the river. Oftentimes, I'll see comments from folks who talk about Covington being a ghost town. And I think, well, that seems like a mischaracterization and an ignorance of what's really happening
there.
Yeah,
I agree.
But I can't say that they're wrong because I don't know what their perspective is. And Katrina, let's bring you back in. I'm curious if there is a population in this region that is so left out of what's happening that they don't even know what's happening.
Yeah, I think for sure. As we talk with especially the low-income population, a lot of times they just don't even know. They're not in the conversation, and they're just dealing with their day-to-day lives. They're just trying to get to work, trying to get their kids done, and they've not been brought into that conversation. So you see two different cities, and not just in Covington, but regionally. You know, we represent eight counties, and it's like that in all of those counties. There's people that's left out of the conversation because, you know, there's new developments coming in and there's meetings and there's all these conversations. But if you don't have time or access to get to those meetings, then you're not part of that conversation. And you really don't know. I can talk to two people, two or three streets apart from each other, and one person will fully understand what's happening and one will have no idea.
And it's kind of true of the urban renaissance, isn't it? It's really block to block. You can see a block of transformation and a block of an area that's really in need. 513-419-7100 is the number to call to join our conversation. Let's go to the phones now. We have Jerry on the line. Hi, Jerry. What's your question or comment?
Yes, I noticed that the people on the panel mentioned that income is an important part of affordable housing, a certain percentage, I think 30%. So the question is, why should government be supplementing or giving breaks to people when corporations are not paying a livable wage that would allow these people to get the housing that they want. So that's my question.
Thanks, Jerry. We'll hang up and let the panel address that. So I guess Jerry's point is, look, we have the opportunity to offer incentives to developers who create housing units for people who make a certain wage, but why not put pressure on some of the corporations to pay more to their employees so that they can afford the housing at market rate?
Well, more and more, as developers come in front of the committee, we do ask the question, what is your average income level of your employees? And the applicants are understanding that if they give a low answer, their request is not going to be well received. So that's important. I agree with him. And we have rules about our employees must be paid at least $15 an hour, $30,000 a year. That's, I'm not even sure that qualifies as livable, but it's an increase. If we had the authority under state law to impose those rules for our employers, private employers, I'm sure we would. That's got to come from state government, national government. That's a whole debate that our society chooses so frequently to leave off the table.
We got an email from Steve in Oakley. He says, quote, the original purpose of tax abatements was to encourage economic activity in challenged areas of the city. Oakley, Hyde Park, Mount Lookout are not economically challenged, but they get them anyway. The policy seems to have evolved from an economic stimulus into an entitlement. You ask, you get. I find the funding of tax abatement programs with money that should have gone to the school district simply very bad policy. Anyone want to react to that?
I mean, the policy of tax abatements, you know, and he's right. They were set up to mean a certain thing, but in their current state, privilege begets privilege in this situation, and so that's why we have to. It's not an incentive if everybody gets it. So we have to bring it back to the pure definition of what it means to incentivize it. So if you know that you're going to build a development or create development, and I don't want to be insensitive to developers. I know their numbers have to work, and they're not nonprofits. They're in it to make money. But I just don't believe the conversation has to be so binary. I feel like it's not. You can be making money as a developer and creating housing that, and we have some, and I've learned too that developers have some leeway as it relates to how we calculate the area median income. They use the county's percentage, which is greater than the city's percentage. So I think we need to, and I don't know if it's instituting a policy, but we need to calculate affordability based on the city of Cincinnati's area median income, which would be more inclusive than the county's because the income, it's the law of averages, they spread out. So that's one way that we can look at how to, from a policy perspective, regulate, income for certain developments.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Jim on the line. Hi, Jim. What's your question or comment?
It was relating to the comment that was made by the councilwoman that Ludlow doesn't want to, or seem to want to have low income as the housing as the entrance to their city. And I don't live in the city of Cincinnati. I live north of Cincinnati in a small town, and we have rental homes, we have some apartments, we have homeowners like myself, and what I tend to see is that the less expensive housing tends to bring in a clientele that does not pick up after themselves. I mean, they'll have junk laying around in the yard, and they just—it's like they don't have the pride in where they live, like people who either have home ownership or tend to spend more for where they're living. And I don't know if it's things that you can do to combat that other than enforcement of local codes and so forth, so that these people that are taking advantage of affordable housing are also held accountable to how they keep up where they are.
All right, Jim, we appreciate the call very much. Thanks. We're going to hang up and let the panel react to your comments there. I think this is kind of what we were discussing about the difference between affordable housing possibly and Section 8. I don't want to stereotype Section 8 users, but this has said a lot about renters in general. And then when you get into the weeds about the types of renters, these are the comments that you hear. Is there accuracy in what he's saying?
I mean, I'm not going to always speak in absolutes, but this is a situation where you recognize the segregation of Cincinnati. He lives north of Cincinnati. I'm not going to make any assumptions about who he knows and who he hangs out with. But chances are, I mean, I know people just because I live in the city and I also grew up in low-income housing that my mother encouraged us to pick up. We had to pick up trash in my neighborhood. So I think he's making an assumption and a stereotype about people who are in affordable housing or low-income housing. So not that he asked for my unsolicited advice, but it would be to get to know people outside of his immediate community and get to know people who take pride. Because I know a lot of people take pride in their homes, whether they rent or they are homeowners.
For sure. I mean, I'm a renter and I live in a building where people tend to take care. I broke all the mini blinds. Okay. I've broken all the mini blinds
you
that
too.
Have been hanging from the windows, but I'm going to pay to replace those at some point. But for the most part, I see responsible renters in the newer developments. I think there is concern, though, in certain neighborhoods among homeowners when a landlord is not taking good care of his property. Does some of the responsibility fall on the property managers themselves? And I'll bring Katrina in for this part because you manage some properties. And what role do you see yourselves in playing to make sure that your residents and that you as an organization are ensuring that the neighborhood remains nice?
Well, just back to his comment, you know, we do own and operate several properties and we've not had this issue because we do set a standard. You know, when you set a standard, then people normally will rise to that standard. And so with our Magnolia Glen, with our Harvest Glen, we've not had any of these issues of property destruction or people not taking care of their property because we do have staff that are on site there that are diligent, just like any other property manager. And then also, too, with our Lincoln Grant Scholar House, that is a special population. And sometimes, you know, people in just haven't been taught some of those things. So we incorporate that into our training, you know, apartment living 101. What is it like to live in an apartment in a community with 45 other people? What are your responsibilities? You know, what are you required to do? What are we going to do? What are we going to do as a community here to ensure that we maintain our property and we take pride in our property? So we do sort of incorporate some of that training into our programming there. But we have a high expectation. And people usually come to that expectation.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Lucy on the line. Hi, Lucy. What's your question or comment?
Hi. My comment is that if we're thinking about investing for the future and what's going to give Cincinnati the better return and shop owners more business, I think it's to keep families in stable situations and not have them have to move all over the place like that article in the Cincinnati Inquirer. What a wonderful article that was on Sunday. Following a family for 9 months. And they had to move, I don't know how many times, until they found somebody who was kind enough to let them live so they could afford it. But I think that kids don't do well, neither do people, when life is chaotic and they don't know when they're going to be evicted. And I understand Cincinnati has a very high rate of eviction. And I really think that Over the Line should definitely have people there who have lived there before and who deserve to stay there, and they deserve good housing and safe housing, and that's just my point.
Thank you so much for the call, Lucy. We appreciate that. That article in the Inquirer was by journalists Mark Kernute and Alberto Caesar. We had them on the show, the Friday News Review on Friday, talking about that, a very depressing look at one family's real-life experience in Cincinnati. Back to the phones now. We have Charles on the line. Hi, Charles. What's your question or comment?
Well, the question is, in terms of development and abatements and their income that comes in, it seems that the target for most of this development tends to be people who are, one, empty nesters, two, people of higher income, and three, going into the affordable housing discussion, well, it's important to make sure that you have housing that's available for people who have lower means. You have people now who are working class who can't necessarily afford the apartments, and it seems that's an entire market that's being forgotten. And particularly, it's the market that actually reinvests in the community by local shopping, and also one that stays longer than some of the other types of people. For instance, we have a discussion just over the Rhine. Many people coming in there don't stay that as long as most tenants would. And in the process, once a client leaves, the apartment process or even tends to go up economically. I'm just curious: is there any discussion about how to establish rates or establish a type of development that fits all types of income?
Thank you, Charles. We appreciate the call. We'll let the panel address.
Well, I think partly that's what Tamai is talking about, asking developers to come forward with developments that don't have one income level only, but a mix. The city has a lot of initiatives that are intended to address a number of income levels through the model group, Over the Rhine Housing, 3CDC. Our Department of Community Economic Development has been very successful. We hope to get more successful getting low-income housing tax credits out of Columbus, historic tax credits. We've done particularly well. So a lot of good things going on. Have we solved the problems? No. And 40,000 is a pretty intimidating number. If you think about what kind of investment you have to make to provide housing that is of appropriate quality and that's affordable. It's very difficult to provide affordable housing to somebody who's living at 20 or 30% of area median income without some rent subsidies, which and there are programs that help provide that, not nearly enough.
We'll read a quick part of the COHERE report that came out in June that analyzed the housing situation in Cincinnati. We'll have to leave our interviews there for the day, but I want to make sure that this data was provided. It said, quote, Cincinnati is facing a crisis. There are not enough safe, healthy places where people can reasonably afford to live. Our homelessness rates are at all-time highs. More than 40,000 people across our county are spending more than half of the money they earn on rent, often to live in substandard homes and apartments. This crisis is at the heart of our rising poverty rates. Council members David Mann and Tamai Dennard, good luck in solving that problem. We appreciate you coming on and discuss
so
this
much.
With us.
Thank you.
And Katrina Bowman-Thomas from the Northern Kentucky Community Action Commission, thank you for joining us on the phone today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Up next, the volume is climbing in popular restaurants to alarming decibels. But at least one local establishment may have found a way to help protect our hearing. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstrow. I'm Michael Monks. Subscribe to our podcast at WVXU.org.